This episode of the Sweaty Startup is brought to you by Jobber. Visit getjobber.com/sweaty for 20% off and a free trial of the best customer relationship management software that there is. Customers can get quotes on your website, you can manage your schedule, you can collect payment, you can send invoices, all with the click of a button. It is literally your back office in a box. Visit getjobber.com/sweaty. to learn more. Now, today's episode is with John Warrilow. He is an entrepreneur and writer. He wrote Built to Sell, which is one of my favorite entrepreneurship books. It released in 2010. It actually helped me revolutionize my business in 2012. And he's back to talk on the show today about his new book, The Art of Selling, and also give us some insight into what investors want in a business, what you can do with your business to make it more valuable, and even what you should look for if you're looking to buy a business. And if you want to learn more about this, visit builttosell.com/sweaty. John has some things for us, some videos, a video series about building and selling a valuable business, a 9 subscription models ebook that lets you get some different things to support your business along the way, and a workbook as well. So you can check that out, and let's get started right in this episode. It's awesome. John, welcome to the Sweaty Startup.
Hey, thanks for having me, Nick.
I got to say, so Built to Sell came out in 2010, and 2013, I told you when we spoke recently, was a big changing point, a transitionary year in my business. We simplified our offering. We were able to simplify the job for our employees, and we scaled. And your book allowed us to do that. So I want to say thank you. I recommend it on the Sweaty Startup website, and I'm a huge fan. I feel like I'm in the big leagues getting to sit in front of you.
That's very kind. I'm glad it worked out for you.
Let's talk about it. I mean, I'm on this mission to preach service-based entrepreneurship. I talk about how it can change your life because it's changed mine. My fear and my a serious fear as I start to go on this journey and I'm getting traction, I'm influencing more people. My fear is that I'm going to create I'll create a bunch of folks who are 40 years old, 50 years old. They're tied to their business. Their business has no intrinsic value. They're working 80 hours a week. They are not even making good money. They have no life balance, and their business has completely overwhelmed them. And I know it happens. I know it happens a lot. We see it. I see it. You see it. I want to talk to those people today.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's a real issue, right? Where the illusion of entrepreneurship just seems so alluring, right? And in the early days, I think it is. You know, it's a great way to make a living, and particularly in a service business where there's very little capital up front. It's, you know, it's your own time, it's your own sweat, and you get it off the ground. And but there's a next stage beyond just selling your time or selling your effort to thinking, and you went through this yourself, to thinking of it more as an asset that could be transferable one day. And that's that's kind of level 2 entrepreneurship. I think level 1 is, you know, selling your time, which is great, but level 2 is figuring out, okay, how does this thing work without me being the linchpin? And that's, I think, the secret to the freedom that most people aspire to have. Well, most people, why they don't get a job on Wall Street or go work for Procter & Gamble, it's because there's a vein of independence running through us, I think, and we want freedom if that's the primary motivation of what we're doing.
So before we talk about your new book, The Art of Selling the Business, where you dive into the dynamics of selling a company, which came a couple months too late, by the way. I sold my company in January.
Sorry, man.
But before we talk about that, I want to dive into a little bit of this concept in Built to Sell. There's a little bit of a contradiction in the book, whereas, you know, Built to Sell sounds like an event. It sounds like a stationary moment in time where that business transacts. But throughout the book, the theme is we're trying to build something that's going to be here forever. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? What seems to be a kind of a contradiction?
It's funny. I did a podcast a while ago, and the guy starts off and he says, "Oh, Warlow, yeah, I know you. You're the douchebag who wrote Built to Sell." That was his opening line.
Why did he say that?
Douchebag. But like, well, he said that because he thought Built to Sell was about building to flip. The idea that you kind of get in, get out, maximize your return, and you know, kind of ride off into the sunset. And that's not what it's about at all. It's really about building a business that can thrive without you so that you've got the ultimate poker hand, right? I don't know if you're a poker player, Nick, but you know, when you get a great hand, it gives you options, right? There's lots of ways you can play that hand out. And similarly, I think if you build a company that's not dependent on you, it gives you options. You could sell it if you want, or you could bring in a manager to run it day to day. You could bring in a private equity group to take off, you know, some of the shares and continue to run it. I mean, you've just got lots of options. And I think, you know, to your point earlier, a lot of businesses where the owner is at the epicenter, they're not sellable. And they're also not businesses that can live without the owner. And so you reach a point, we call it the Rainmaker's Dilemma, where somewhere in, you know, $500,000-$700,000 in revenue, you're the bottleneck and your business plateaus. And a lot of guys and gals get to that point and they're like, okay, well, I guess that's it for me. Right. And they, you know, they have a lifestyle business, but to punch above that threshold, I think it means it's a subtle shift in your mindset. You know, I know you're a parent and I'm a parent too. And so, you know, part of my parenting philosophy is like, I don't want it'd be great if my kid went to Harvard, but I don't need him to go to Harvard, right? Like that's not the aspiration. They don't have to be a quarterback for Alabama. Like I would love for them to become functioning adults in the world where they're happy in what they're doing, et cetera. And I think a lot of business owners would be better served thinking of their job as like, I'm the parent of my company, as opposed to the CEO of your company, right? Like as a parent, what are you, you're not trying to take center stage. You actually want your kids to, as they go into being teenagers, to kind of get on their own two feet and start making decisions on their own. And ultimately it is so much more fulfilling for parents out there. It's so much more fulfilling to see your kids succeed than it is to see you succeed, right? Like in the same way, like in a business, there's nothing more tantalizing. There is nothing more motivating to watch somebody you employ go out and make a sale that you didn't have to make. There is just, that's like crack for an entrepreneur. That is unbelievable feeling to see somebody else do the work and get a customer to say yes without you having to do anything.
Let's dive into that. So you're a parent of a company. I think we have a lot of people in that situation. They have a business that's maybe making a lot of money, but all the problems come to them. All the problems come their way. It was me at a time where the phone rang. I knew it was a problem because I didn't get the good news. I was the problem solver. So what are the mistakes that you see people make? And let's talk about making that transition. I know it's not easy.
Yeah, no, it is not. And the fundamental kind of idea is, instead of selling lots of things to a few people, selling a few things to lots of people. And those sound like the same. I just twisted the words around. It's actually 180 degrees different, right? What the best companies, the most valuable businesses, the ones like yours that you went through this transition of selling, you know, having 28 things for the drivers to do to having 5 things for the drivers to do. Like that's the kind of transition that makes it simple, because as an entrepreneur, you are likely really good at a lot of things. And it is tempting to fulfill a lot of customer demands because you can do it. The challenge is the people you employ can't. And therefore, the trick to getting you out of that sort of that rainmaker's dilemma, so to speak, is to sell less things to more people. And so it's a, you know, it's one that I, you know, I did a podcast with a woman named Stephanie Breedlove, and it to my, you know, to this day, it's one of my favorite episodes of Built to Sell Radio. She built a company so she had a kid and she wanted to pay a nanny and she wanted to do it legitimately above board. So she hired a payroll company, or she went to look for a payroll company. None of the payroll companies wanted their business, right? Because they're doing deals for Ford and General Motors. I mean, they don't want to do payroll for some lady who wants to pay her nanny. And so she got a terrible experience. And she decided to start a payroll company that would just focus on doing payroll for parents who have a nanny. So she builds this business up. She gets to 300 grand in revenue. So it's her and one employee. And she's finding it more difficult to acquire new customers. And so she's got a fork in the road, right? On one hand, she can go sell more things to her existing parents, right? Like, what do busy parents, two income parents need? They need like lawn care and they need meal delivery. And like, there's a lot of stuff you could cross sell, right? Or she could take the much more difficult road, double down on her niche and find more parents who have a nanny to pay. And to her credit, even though everybody under the sun was saying, oh, it's 10 times more profitable to go cross-sell an existing service to a new service to an existing client, she didn't follow that route. She went the other way and said, you know what, I'm going to double down on payroll for nannies. And
over 25 years, she built her business to $9 million in revenue. So this is not Tesla, right? This is not some juggernaut of a company. This is a, this, over 25 years, she kind of grew at 10, 15, 20% a year. Over 25 years, she gets $9 million. She's got 10,000 customers. And decides, okay, now I want to sell. And she goes out and looks at the universe, and care.com is the Angie's List of care providers, right? Like, plug in your postal code, zip code, and it'll, you know, 5-star rated babysitters pop out. Well, you think about it, they had 7 million subscribers at the time. All of those subscribers are parents that have a nanny or a babysitter to pay. So she goes to the woman who ran Care and she's like, you should buy my company. Long story short, care.com pays $54 million for a $9 million company. And it would never have happened had she started cross-selling additional services to her existing customers. She had the courage to say, no, that's not what I got into business to do. That I can't scale that. I can't train people to do all those different things. I can train people to do payroll for nannies. And it made her journey much slower than a lot of people listening. There's a lot of people listening to this, you know, they aspire to be the next Silicon Valley startup. It's going to go to $1 billion in a few years. She did it the much sweatier way, the much harder way, but turned out well.
Man, I love it. So let's say you are in, let's talk to a lawn care specialist in Bloomington, Indiana, who sounds maybe good. Maybe they're growing a little bit every year and they're trying to think about whether they want to start doing big landscaping projects or pest control or pressure washing or all the other things that you see landscaping companies branch out to that then inhibits their growth. Mm-hmm. Talk to them about what to do when maybe they're bumping up against a wall or they're trying to figure out which way to go.
Yeah, to figure out your TVR. TVR stands for teachable, valuable, repeatable. It's a service that you could teach employees to offer that is valuable to customers. The opposite of valuable is commoditized. So simple lawn care may be commoditized. And it's repeatable, meaning the customers need it on a recurring basis. And so your TVR is the essence of building a sellable service company. It's what you need to do to get it out of your hands and into your team's hands. And when people go through that process, in particular lawn care, for example, they're going to look at all the services they could provide. So weeding and you know, laying new sod and hardscaping and all, you know, all that stuff. They're going to look at it, and there, some services are going to be more teachable, others more valuable, others more repeatable. What often happens is the most teachable services to offer that you get a high school kid to do are also the least valuable. In other words, most commoditized. Right? That's very natural. So when that happens to you, don't be like dissuaded and go, ah, I can't figure this out. That's very natural. My advice, what most people do is they're like, okay, great. I've got to find something really differentiating and try to teach people to do that. That's a fool's errand. It's going to be really hard to do that because the reason you can do it is it's been years of experience doing it. And it's very difficult to just kind of automatically transfer that knowledge. My advice is to do the exact opposite, is to find something teachable and offer something different. And so I'll give you an example from snow removal. I interviewed a guy on Built to Sell Radio who had a snow removal company. And I said, snow removal is the most commoditized service you could possibly have. Like, how did you guys differentiate yourself? And he's like, you know what we offered to do? Well, first of all, we didn't do residential. We did restaurants. So they went to restaurants who needed to keep their drive-throughs clear of snow in the Northeast. So they had a niche they focused on. And I said, but what was it that made you different than the other three snow removal companies that did commercial jobs? He said, we offered to pick up the cigarette butts. I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, well, we think about it. A lot of guys go to the drive-through and they flick their cigarette butts on the ground. And after a while, it's disgusting. And you're about to eat like a Big Mac and you're looking at all these dead cigarette butts. And he said, I offered to do the cigarette butt cleanup as part of our snow removal service. Totally set him apart, teachable, valuable, repeatable. He got drivers to be willing to pick up the cigarette butts as part of their service. And it's an example of where you take a service, commoditize, and just kind of one-up it. And that's mm-hmm. that's what I would suggest for anybody in the lawn care or snow removal or any of those categories.
Amping up the service to where you can charge more and you don't need every single customer. You need the ones who are willing to pay for that extra nudge.
Yeah. And I think amping up, yes, as well as branding it. So, you know, Tony Hsieh, famous late entrepreneur who started Zappos, the late Tony Hsieh, I should say, he was famous for branding his service differentiators, right? So he had the two-way refund policy. So it was not only that we're going to ship you the shoes for free when you order them on Zappos, but if you didn't like them for any reason, we would pay to ship them back. And that became a brand. Like it's when you brand that service offering is when it becomes tangible for your customers. It's also when you don't need you personally to deliver it. So if you brand your service differentiator, you make it like sound like a product or a thing. Your employees can refer to it. It doesn't need you as the chief salesperson or the guy or gal who's most passionate about your customer to try to explain your customer service. Because customer service is not a differentiator, because you have to experience customer service for you to believe it's a differentiator. So it's a great way to keep customers. It's not a great way to win customers, because people are like, oh, you offer great service? Yeah, like the other five guys said exactly the same thing, right? But if you've got the two-way guarantee or the cigarette removal system, right? That's branded differentiation. And that's one-upping it. It's not only figuring out what your TVR is, but then kind of branding it, productizing that service offer.
Do you have any thoughts around hiring? Because this is the toughest labor market in the history of the world. So there's a lot of entrepreneurs out there who maybe they have customers running out their ears. Maybe they have the TVR. Maybe they have this, they're ready to go, and they just can't find people to execute.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a tough market and it's been distorted, right? So it is very tough to find people right now. And I empathize with that. I think one of the benefits of doing some of the work we're talking about today is it lowers the bar for people to follow your systems. Like if you don't systematize and you make them drive the trucks with 28 different things on the back of the iPad or whatever, like you need really good people. You need people to think on their own. You need entrepreneurial people. You need very intuitive people, people to solve problems. Like every one of those things requires a much higher degree of person. Whereas you narrow it down, you do one thing. We do snow removal for drive-throughs and you got to pick up the cigarette butts. That really lowers, frankly, the kind of skill set and experience that you need. And so you can get some semi-skilled and some kind of manual job people without necessarily great college degrees, without lots of other offerings. So I'm not suggesting it's easy. It is difficult to get those people, but it does lower the bar a lot when you aren't relying on them to be entrepreneurial and thinking for themselves, if you will.
Do employees want autonomy? I mean, I guess it depends. Right? That's a big one.
We talked about this on your episode of Bill Sutter. I agree with you 100%. I think employees are employees for a reason. I think they want mastery. I think they want to feel like they're doing a great job for customers. I feel like they want to feel that sense of like, I know how to do this, right? We've all had those experiences in sports where after a certain, maybe it's 10,000 hours or whatever, you get to a point where you're like, you know what? I could do this. Right. I think employees love that feeling and they're employees for a reason. And one of the things that I think I made in my early career is, my first couple of businesses, I was like, why don't you see it my way? Right. Like we could do this together. And if you just took less in salary and like took more in performance-based incentives, or, we're going to have all these cultural things to make this company a great place to work. And I was trying to make them into entrepreneurs. Right. And I realized eventually I'm like, they're not entrepreneurs. That's not what gets them out of bed, right? So what they want is a good, they want to be fairly treated. They want to get paid when you say you're going to pay them. They want options to get advancement. They want a safe working environment. And like, if you tick those boxes, like they're happy 90% of the time. Sure, there's some that are really ambitious and they want to take on the world and you've got to somehow find a way to keep them engaged. But most people, it's a job, and just treat it like a job.
Okay, next random question. Can entrepreneurship be taught? You asked me this, caught me off guard. I have my own opinion, but do you think that entrepreneurship can be taught? I mean, I'm of the mindset that you read a book like Built to Sell, and if you don't do the work to think on that book and apply that book to your situation and your own problems or your own company, it's a lot less valuable. If I read your book and I didn't have a business, I maybe would have learned some things about how business works, but I had to do the work to apply your book to my business. can it be taught? I mean, does entrepreneurship work when you're teaching it in the MBA classes?
Yeah, look, I think it depends the kind of entrepreneurship you want to play. I think if your goal is to start a service business, low capital involvement, I don't think you need to go to Babson and take entrepreneurship. I think you can very much build a service business, bootstrap it, build it into a very successful, very profitable business, and in some ways make it your training wheels business, right? Like get some money in your jeans, get some experience and leverage that, as you have in many ways, into another business, right? Which maybe is more capital intensive, does need you to talk to investors and sort of have some of the skills that you learn by doing. So I think that does not require a sophisticated degree to do it. I think, however, there is a style of entrepreneurship which is much more capital intensive, where you do need to play in a different sort of swimming pool, which an entrepreneurship degree does help. It formalizes, I think, the some of the things investors look for in opportunities, the way you raise money, et cetera, et cetera. I think we're aligned on this. I think a lot of kids think entrepreneurship is Silicon Valley, and I think they would be much better served doing the work. But I think you get a Stanford degree or you get a Babson degree, there are benefits to that. But I don't think you can ever, I think you and I are aligned on this. I don't think you can ever manufacture teach hunger, willingness to fail and make mistakes and pick yourself up and iterate. I got into this debate one time about the importance of a business plan, and I think they're horseshit. I really think they're garbage. I think people, every bank, every school says, oh, you got to have a business plan. They're not worth the paper they're printed on. And people say, oh, there's value in planning. Well, there's not if it's just a house of cards and a bunch of assumptions built on assumptions. I think what you need a business plan is when you want to go from $300,000 in sales to $3 million in sales, that's a great time to build a business plan, right? Because you've got real world data at that point. You have $300,000 worth of sales, right? How did you make those sales? How many people did you have to talk to win a customer? How much did it cost you to serve that customer, et cetera, et cetera. That's a great time to write a business plan. Not when you're in your dorm or you're working at McDonald's, you're trying to figure out how to start a business. Trust me, do it. Do the work. Try to make a sale. That's where you will learn what works. And then you could feed that data into a spreadsheet later, but not in a startup. Mm-hmm. So how did I get out of that?
Double-edged sword. Yeah. I love it. I love the rant. I feel exactly the same way that, you need the data. You need to see what's working. You need to experience what the real world is like before you think too much, because this is a business where you can really overthink it. I think that's a mistake that a lot of people make. So let's talk about the art of selling, unless you have something to add there.
Well, I was just going to add one thing, Nick, because I was kind of talking about the kind of skills, qualities, and I think the kind of grit and willingness to fail and fall on your face is really important. The other piece is curiosity. And I think I see that is lacking a lot in young people when they approach business, because I think we've been so focused on, manufacturing these robots as students. Like, you must memorize the textbook, you must get 95 to get into this school, et cetera, et cetera. And we're not appreciating that curiosity is the secret sauce of entrepreneurship, right? And you've probably seen this in your own world, I'm sure, Nick. Like, when you meet someone really successful, very successful, like hundreds of millions of dollars successful, my bet is they ask you more questions than you ask them. My bet is they're like, Nick, you're in the storage business. Like, tell me a little bit about it. I've never talked, how does that work? And like, you're like, why are they asking me all these questions? They've obviously been successful, but that's how they got successful, is they are just voracious consumers of information. And they're just inherently curious. Like, I'm looking at the bike behind you and I'm like, how does that feel to ride the bike inside on the spinner wheel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The great thing about entrepreneurship is that you get to make a lot of educated guesses and then you just get to see what happens. It's really exciting. It's like sports. It's the curiosity in real time. You're making assumptions, you're making guesses, and you're diving into uncertainty, and you watch that uncertainty come back positive or negative and you adjust.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about the art of selling. And again, talk to the sweaty startup audience of folks who are running service businesses. What are some key concepts in this book that you think we could take away from this?
The first is, you know, the book is really designed to help you punch above your weight when you go to sell your company. That's effectively what it is. It's intended to be a recipe book or kind of a cheat sheet on how to punch above your weight. So it's really focused on that principle. However, there's one thing that has nothing to do with negotiation. I think it's probably the place to start. And that is what we have found is that the most successful exits, the ones where the entrepreneurs at the end of the day are happiest with their decision, the number of pull factors outweigh the number of push factors. So pull factors are the things you're excited to go do next. Push factors are the things that are frustrating you about your business, the pandemic, regulation, employees. Those are all push factors. You got to have them. That's
you mean push them away from me. I'm done with this. Kind of, yeah.
Push you out of your business.
Yeah,
I'm being pushed out of my business because of all these factors. Whereas pull factors are like, I want to run an Ironman. I want to write a book. I want to start another business. I want to start a charity. Those are all really amazing magnetic pull factors. And the secret to, I think, one of the foundational, I shouldn't say secret, one of the foundations, I mean, think of having a happy exit where you look back on it with pride and a sense of accomplishment is like having those pull factors. So I know that's a bit of a cop-out answer, but that's a really important one. I did an interview with a guy named Sean Oshman. And Sean built a great little company. It was an IT services business, sweaty startup, up by the bootstraps, $2 million in revenue, $200,000 in profit. And he was 39. And when he woke up on his 39th birthday, he's like, I want to live on a sailboat, right? He's living in Denver. It's landlocked. He's like, it's a weird thing to think about, but he's like, I want to go live and feel like what it feels like to live on a sailboat. And he says, I want to do that by the time I'm 40. So he goes and hires a broker, comes back, gets an offer of, I think, 2.5 times profit. So like, it's not a grand slam home run kind of exit. It's like the pretty standard small business exit, 2 to 3 times profit. And I kind of called him on it on his interview. And I was like, but Sean, like, it wasn't like his grand slam exit. And he's like, yeah, but John, you're kind of missing the point. I'm like, okay, what's the point? He's like, I live on a sailboat. And so I've always remembered that as an example of a guy who had a really clear pull factor. And so I think, before you get involved, you start to think about how do I punch above my weight and all the kind of do's and don'ts of negotiating the sale of your company. Like, just get really clear. What are you going to go do next? And what and are you excited about that?
What are some of the things that buyers love to see in businesses, especially the businesses with under $1 million in EBITDA? And by EBITDA, I mean profit that goes in the bank.
Yeah, for sure. So look, there's three types of buyers, right? Individual investors buying usually very small businesses, service-based businesses, the kind of sweaty startups I think we're talking about. Those are generally individual investors. There are private equity buyers that buy some sweaty startups. So there'll be private equity groups that are rolling up lawn care companies, for example. So that can be another option. And then there are strategic buyers. That would be somewhat rare for a sweaty startup. So let's focus on individual investors and private equity groups. So the individual investor is a guy or gal who says, oh, I want to move to Baltimore. And they say, maybe I'll just buy a business because I don't want to get a job. And so they say, okay, great. I'm going to buy a business. I know a little bit about lawn care. I had a business when I was a kid in lawn care. Great. I'm going to look for lawn care businesses in Baltimore. And they figure out that you're selling your business. What they need is for your business to be bankable, because generally they're not, if they're coming to create a job, they're generally not coming with money, cash, to buy your business with cash, right? They're going to get some bank to lend them some money. And maybe the SBA finances a portion of that as well, which is a guarantee that the government provides. So they really need your business to be bankable. Bankable businesses are predictable. They have revenue and profit that is relatively stable, continues to kind of go in year after year. There's not a lot of customer concentration. It's not like one customer is 80% of your revenue. Those are all things that make your business more bankable. So essentially, if you want to know whether you have a sellable business, if your goal is to sell to an individual investor, it's the same criteria banks look for in order to finance you and give you a loan, right? The private equity group is slightly different. What they're doing is rolling up industries, which means that for them, they've got the sort of infrastructure, they've got the billing scheduling infrastructure. And so what they're really looking for is customer lists, right? So when they, if you've got 50 customers on contract and you do snow removal for them, well, guess what? They can just roll that into their infrastructure, their existing platform, and it becomes accretive. Accretive, think of accretive as like they might buy your business for say 5x EBITDA, but they're rolling these businesses up. And because they're scalable and it's much larger, businesses generally go up in value on a multiple of EBITDA as they grow in size. And so if they buy a bunch of small independent lawn care or snow removal businesses for 5x profit, they might get to sell that entire collection of businesses for 8 or 9x profit. And so not only are they making money along the way, but they're also getting an accretive bump when they go to sell the much larger business. And by the way, when they buy a bunch of independent businesses, oftentimes they scrape out some of the admin people because they don't need 6 people to do scheduling and 12 people to do, you know, answer the phones. And so there's also, you know, economic incentives for them to do roll up. So again, for those guys, they're looking for recurring revenue generally is one of the things that's going to be like honey to a bee for a private equity group. They want to see that you've got contracts with your customers, that they repeat and recur on a regular cadence. That's probably their number one.
Love it. So you're 5 years out, or maybe you're just starting a business. Is there anything that you should keep in mind then when you're starting, or when you're a ways away from potentially selling a company, that would set you up well for this event and preparing for it and maximizing value when it comes?
Yeah, I think it makes sense to know who your strategic acquirers are or the private equity companies in your category, and to start looking like one of those. You know, I don't want to debase selling your business or building the value of your business down to just semantics and optics, but optics do matter because, you know, Reese and Trout, the guys who wrote Positioning the Battle for Your Mind, they talked about the fact that as consumers become inundated with marketing messages, we look to make shortcuts, right? Like we look to try to categorize a product. Oh, they're, you know, that's a beer, that's a running shoe. And like, we have a bunch of synapses in our brain that knows what a beer is or knows what running shoes are. And so that helps us kind of accelerate the adoption of information. Similarly, acquirers also use shortcuts, right? And they are inundated with, investors are inundated with options or people that want to sell them their business. And so they use shortcuts. And so if you can start looking like a company that acquirers would want to buy, like for example, if you get wind that there is a private equity group rolling up lawn care businesses, well, your website should make it clear you're a lawn care business, even if you also do snow removal, and even if you also build decks, and even if you also do weed control. If you look like a diversified set of products and services, most private equity companies are going to walk because they're going to want know you're going to want to pay for all of your business, and you look like a squishy mishmash of stuff, right? But if you have a website and you rank social on search engine optimization, like on Google for lawn care, when a private equity group says, okay, we're going to move into Boston, so who are the lawn care? They're going to literally Google Boston lawn care, and you need to be one of the top five listed people. And if you diluted and you're doing weed control and a bunch of other stuff, it means that you won't necessarily get their attention. So figure out who the strategics are and look like one of those. I'll give you a real life example from the book. It comes from a company called Embanet. Embanet was started by these two partners, and they did college courses. So they basically helped universities and colleges put their content online. And in the early days, they kind of looked at themselves as just kind of a web design shop. They just happened to have a niche of working with these colleges, right? So they kind of carried themselves and talked about themselves, and their website referred to them as a web design shop, right? Well, guess what? They got an offer to buy their web design shop, similar to what most service businesses get, which is about 3x earnings, 3x profit. And they were like, you know what? You spend a lot of time in this business. We want to kind of do better than that. So they started to look at how they could rethink their business and re-talk about it differently. And what they realized, that not only were they a web design shop, but they were actually kind of pioneers in this e-learning space, because they were working with these fancy universities, Vanderbilt, Boston College, and helping them put their content online. And so they said, well, we're really not just a sort of a generic web design shop. We're actually kind of leaders in this e-learning space. And this is around the time that Lynda was acquired by LinkedIn. LinkedIn itself was acquired. Like, everybody wanted to be in the e-learning space. Well, 2.5 years later, they got an offer from a group rolling up e-learning companies for 13 times EBITDA.
So it's about simplifying. It's about the niche. It's about the niche. It's about simplifying and finding that niche that maybe is super valuable to a strategic buyer.
That's exactly right. And kind of looking like the kind of company they want to buy, you know, like, yeah, it's about the niche, but, and using the vocabulary of the acquirer. So if you learn that there's a private equity group rolling up dental practices, well, then you want to look like a dental practice. You don't want to look like an integrated, you know, medical center.
We see the same mistake in real estate. Investors are opportunists. They build these self-storage facilities in these small towns, and they'll see an opportunity to maybe put a duplex on the site, or maybe put an industrial building on the site, or maybe put a barber shop on the site that they can rent out. Well, I'm rolling up self-storage. I only want self-storage. So sure. Maybe it added value to that person. Maybe it added value to that person, but it does not add value to me. So the value is not there when you exit. So that can happen a lot, right? And another mistake that I see, to kind of shift gears a little bit, another mistake that I see entrepreneurs make is they will constantly reinvest in their business to a point where they'll never get that money back out. That's a fear that I have. They're always buying new equipment or buying new trucks or doing new things when it's not really adding to the value of the business that they're going to sell. So yeah, there's some landmines here. There's some mistakes that can really mess up your ROI when you sell.
Yeah, I think that is so important. I'm so glad you raised the kind of reinvesting in the business, because, you know, like when an acquirer looks at your company, they're going to need to write two checks, right? They're going to write a check to you to buy your company, but they write a second check. It's one that's often misunderstood. And the second check they write is to your company to fund its working capital. And working capital is kind of fancy accountant talk for like how much money you need to have in the company to meet its immediate obligations, right? And the trick is that both of those checks get drawn from the same bank account. So if you have a business that's very capital intensive, you're always buying trucks and you're always buying gear and equipment and inventory, the acquirer is going to look at that and go, man, I got to put a lot of cash into this company to keep funding its business model, right? And so their appetite to write a check to you, the owner, diminishes, because again, both checks get drawn on the same account. Whereas if you've been much more efficient in your capital, you're renting trucks when you need them, as opposed to buying them, having them sit on a lot, as a simple example, you're all of a sudden becoming a cash machine. You're generating cash. I'm not talking about EBITDA now. I'm actually talking about money in your bank account. And the more money that you're accumulating as you grow, the less working capital they need to invest, and therefore the fatter the check they're willing to write you, because they're like, we don't have to fund the working capital. The business just generates cash as it grows. And so it's, you know, we myopically focus, I think, as entrepreneurs, is like, what's the offer? Like, what's the number, right? And I think we oftentimes ignore or maybe minimize the importance of the second number, which is how they're going to calculate working capital. And that can drive a huge amount of value for a lot of entrepreneurs.
Yeah. So I hear, I've had a couple of people on the show. One, Nick Bradley, he buys micro businesses, small businesses with $100,000 to $500,000 in EBITDA. And he says that he has had from the perspective of a buyer, he's at a serious advantage because there are more companies trying to sell than there are buyers trying to buy, because there's a lot of baby boomers who have these businesses. It relies heavily on them. There's a lot of lift from a lot of risk from an investor who wants to acquire that business. Talk to somebody who might want to buy a business. What is the best strategy as being that solo investor who maybe wants to move to another town, buy a business? What are you looking for to make sure that you're getting some decent value if you make that leap?
Well, everything that we talk to entrepreneurs about doing, you want to make sure they haven't done any of those things, right? So, I mean, if you want to get a deal and you know, create a tremendous amount of value, that's the essence of private equity, right? It is buy low, sell high, right? It's finding an asset that is undervalued, underperforming, and improving it. And you're doing it in self-storage with all the automation that you're bringing into these units. I'll give you an example in a car wash industry. You want to talk about sweaty businesses. Like, car washing is one of those like quintessential small businesses, right? You buy a piece of land, it's on a good corner, you build a car wash, and it's a transactional business model. Well, savvy private equity groups are, before I give you this, the kind of private equity story, I'll let you, like, you can think about car washes and know that it's a crappy business model in many ways, because it's great in May when, in April, when people want to get the salt from the winter off their cars, but on a rainy day in November, you've got zero revenue, right? With all the costs, but none of the revenue. And so there are private equity companies rolling up car washes right now. They're buying them cheap and they're converting them into all you can eat subscription-based car washes. So you pay $30 a month and you can go as many times as you want to get your car washed. Well, it's an incredible business model because they don't have any of the cost of acquisition. Once you become a subscriber, you stay for many years. Number two, you're getting paid in November when it's raining, and not everybody wants to get their car washed every second of the day. And so people don't actually get their car washed that much, but it creates this incredible recurring revenue stream. And then when they roll up a subscription-based car wash company with recurring revenue, it's worth many, many times more than a transactional business model. Like, we see this in virtually every industry, not just car washes. I'll give you an example in the security space where they do, you know, home security or office security. You know, they have two forms of revenue. They've got the installation revenue, which is the kind of one and done, wire up the sensors, et cetera. And then they've got recurring revenue, which is the kind of monitoring revenue, right? They'll pay right now about 75 cents for every dollar of installation revenue. And acquirers right now are paying about $3 for every dollar of recurring revenue. And again, that's the same in virtually every industry, right? So these guys in the private equity space of car washes are buying these transactional business models for very low multiples. They're putting in a subscription model and they're flipping them downstream for a subscription-like multiple. And that's incredibly accretive, right? So that's a great business model.
Yeah, you find, you know, what is really valuable to an investor. I'm going to find a business that has the potential, but it's not quite there yet. And yeah, worst case, you have a business that creates a lot of cash flow for yourself and your family. So yeah. Who is your book written for? Who should, if somebody's listening to this right now, who should pick it up and what would they take away from it? What would be the main thing that they would take away?
Yeah, The Art of Selling Your Business, the persona was, for me, a guy or a gal with 1 to 10 million in annual revenue. Does that mean that someone with 500 grand in revenue wouldn't benefit? No, I think they would benefit. And clearly there are larger companies that would benefit as well. But, you know, that's a space where it's often overlooked by the true professional M&A professionals that oftentimes have a sort of minimum criteria of kind of like $10 million of value, et cetera. Yet it's where I think the art of selling your business is so important. It's like, it's about the narrative you play. It's about who you approach. Stephanie Breedlove had a $9 million company. It's not a huge business, right? But she got $54 million for it. It's that person who I think where they probably don't have the most sophisticated banker at their side. So they need to know the game. They need to understand the way it works. And yet they built a real business. It's not just a coffee shop that's going to trade for the value of the underlying real estate. It's actually a business where you're trying to get paid for it as a company. It's ongoing profitability. It's what accountants refer to as goodwill, right? It's the value of the business beyond just the assets in the company. And I think that's the person that I was trying to talk to with The Art of Selling Your Business.
Yeah. That's great. This is great. So what is, what's next for you? I mean, you wrote Built to Sell story format. Is this also in a story format? I loved the fact that Built to Sell was, you could read it and it was a story and you saw it happen and the concepts were in an entertaining, digestible way. I loved it.
Well, thanks for saying that. It is stories, not a story. The Art of Selling Your Business is really what I did after I wrote Built to Sell. I built this podcast called Built to Sell Radio, where I've been doing interviews with entrepreneurs about their exit for I don't know, 6 years now. Every week I do another story and say, you know, what did you do? How did you do it? Et cetera. It's how I met you. And we did an episode together a couple of days ago. And it's been amazing to watch some of the guests on the show and the way they approach their exit. Most people kind of get a standard multiple for their company. If you know, lawn care companies are trading at 3x SDE, that's kind of what they get. Yet there's this sort of other group, call it a cohort of the people I've interviewed, that again, seem to punch well above their weight. They're getting multiples of revenue, not EBITDA. They're doing something differently. And that's kind of what I tried to do in that book, is effectively decode what their approach to the process of selling your business was. Like, how do they look at it differently? How do they think about it differently? What narrative do they tell? Who do they approach, et cetera? And that was the, so the book is really focused on telling their stories. So it is a story format, but in this case, as opposed to a fictional story, which was built to sell, they're actually real life stories. Stories like Stephanie Breedlove and a bunch of others that approach this in a very kind of calculating way.
Love it. Where can people learn more about you, John? We'll wrap it up, but this has been excellent.
Yeah. So builttosell.com/sweaty. We put together a little vanity URL for your listeners. So there's 9 videos on what drives the value of your company. There's the Art of Selling Your Business workbook, which is a free download. And there's the 9 subscription model checklist. So it's all just builttosell.com/sweaty.
I'm a big fan of your work. Thanks for everything. And we'll do this again. I know we will.
I hope so. Thanks, Nick.